Welcome back, or as we say in Texas, giddy up. And listen, this thing we're about to get into here, obviously for the first hour, we just had a conversation about free speech, issues of free speech on college campuses. And in this second hour, we're going to be talking about the issue of freedom of association. I have a sense that many of you are going to identify with the problem that I talk about here in the second section a little bit more closely. It's going to raise some issues that I think tie in pretty closely with what's going on at Hobby Lobby right now. But we need to understand kind of how this all developed. These problems that we run into on the campuses do not pop up overnight. The issue of problems concerning freedom of association on my campus actually began in the year 2003. And this was already just a few months after I started writing for townhall.com. I was at that time the advisor for the College Republicans on my campus. And we had a crazy situation that popped up where the university decided in 2003 to go ahead and implement a new non-discrimination clause. And this non-discrimination clause said that student groups on the campus could not discriminate along the lines of a number of variables. Well, one of the incredibly strange things that was a part of the non-discrimination clause was political belief. They decided that they were going to make the political groups sign this, so that my College Republican group was being asked to not discriminate on the basis of politics. What they were asked to do was to allow Democrats to join the group and be voting members, and to allow Democrats to run for office. Okay? This is pretty incredible because it's the same story over and over again. When we go back to the emo controversy that I told you about, what was the conflict? The conflict was between the United States Constitution and a policy in the university handbook. Well, this idea of telling a political group or a belief-based group that they cannot organize themselves around their beliefs not only defies common sense, it defies the United States Constitution. In the year 1958, there was a case that went before the Supreme Court, and it was a case that was known as NAACP versus Alabama, when some incredibly ugly things were happening in the state of Alabama towards the NAACP. What happened then was that members of the Klan were attempting to get a hold of membership lists of the NAACP, and the NAACP didn't want to turn them over. Because what were they going to do? They're going to find members and they're going to go and drag them out of their homes in the middle of the night and lynch them. And white supporters as well. They're going to harass them and intimidate them. So they said, we're not turning over our membership list. And so they said, well, you should have your tax-exempt status removed as a 501c3 group. And this is the case, and your state tax exemption should be lifted as well. And this is a case that went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and it's the first case, in my knowledge, where the Supreme Court actually just formally and explicitly recognized that we have a constitutional freedom of association in the First Amendment. And what's very interesting about that case is that if you actually read the entire opinion, in about six different places, it says that belief-based groups have a right to control their membership, to have complete control over their membership, and decide exactly what they believe in and why. Well, you think about it for just a second. If it were any other way, if you couldn't have a belief-based requirement, what would the KKK do? The KKK would then join the NAACP, and then they would run for office, and they would pass a brand new set of resolutions saying, we are opposed to interracial marriage. We are opposed to racial segregation. We are in favor of lynching. We believe that black people are intellectually inferior to all other races. We all understand that it wouldn't work if they didn't have a right to discriminate on the basis of belief. You know, the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution doesn't say that there shouldn't be any discrimination. It says that there shouldn't be any arbitrary discrimination. I mean, if Ray Charles wanted to be a bus driver for the city of Birmingham, you could discriminate against him because he's blind, but not because he's black. And everyone understands the difference between the two. Except the people that run our secular universities. They started doing this on my campus. They started doing it at UNC Chapel Hill. They started telling Christian groups that they couldn't say they believed in God. In the name of tolerance and inclusion, take "we believe in God" out of your Christian organization's constitution. Well, what do we believe in? Oh, let's switch it to dog, okay? I mean, well, we're not a Christian group anymore, now are we? It's incredible. Well, this case happens on my campus, and the way that I handled it is I had this wonderful, wonderful student by the name of Michael Pomerico, and he was a fighter, and we decided we were just going straight to the airwaves. And I just went with him on local radio shows, and we wrote to the paper, and then one of the professors wrote back defending the policy to the paper and the Wilmington Star News, and I said, okay, if you want to come after me with a switchblade, I've got an Uzi. So I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Times. I think I won that one. But at any rate, we went broader and actually went out into the national media and decided, once again, that we thought that Justice Brandeis had a point when he said that sunlight is often the most powerful of disinfectants. We just basically ridiculed their decision in the court of public opinion. And they backed down. And a lot of people, a lot of Christians say, well, you shouldn't ridicule stupid things. I don't know. I mean, I've read Matthew 23, and I realize that Jesus wasn't Barney. I mean, Jesus would definitely use some strong language sometimes when ridiculing people that were hypocrites. And you notice who he went after? He didn't go after people who were lost. He went after the Pharisees, who were the false teachers, who knew that what they were doing was wrong. And so I think it's okay when we go after the modern-day Pharisees, which are the college administrators. And in this particular case, we did it. We went out there and we shamed them into changing the policy. Well, unfortunately, something really crazy happened about 7 years after that. We went along at my university just fine. Chapel Hill didn't learn its lesson, so I went and found a plaintiff, and we sued them, and we won, and we took care of the problem for a number of years. And then something strange happened in the year 2010. We have had a number of bad and embarrassing Supreme Court decisions in recent years, a number of them. I honestly and sincerely believe that CLS versus Martinez was one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in American history in terms of undercutting our basic religious liberties. And what's shocking about it is that most people don't know what it was all about. There was this case at Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. It's actually a public law school. And it's one of those schools in California. It's just a law school, basically. And there are a number of those where it's not a law school that's attached to a larger university. And there was a situation where a gay activist student at the law school decided that he was going to join the Christian Legal Society. And he wanted to not just join the Christian Legal Society, he wanted to be a leader and lead Bible studies. So this gay activist goes into the Christian Legal Society and he starts leading these Bible studies. And I don't know if he was doing the whole thing about David and Jonathan being gay or what. I hear the same stories all with these, you know, gay Christian activists. You hear the same stories over and over. But clearly what we know is that he was teaching that there's nothing biblically wrong with homosexuality. Well, there's a problem with that. CLS versus Martinez had some statements CLS, the Christian Legal Society, had some statements of faith. They even said that people who are leaders in the organization needed to live a godly lifestyle, that they needed to not only refrain from homosexual conduct, but also refrain from heterosexual conduct outside of marriage. They weren't singling out homosexuals. They had biblically based beliefs on homosexuality, and that was built right into their belief system. So this guy comes in, this gay activist comes in, disrupting everything. Instead of joining a group that shares his beliefs, he decides he's going to join a group that doesn't share his beliefs for the purpose of destroying it in the name of tolerance. So, what does he do? He gets kicked out, predictably. You know, it's like, I want to ask gay activists, you know, what do you think? I mean, do you think the Klan should have been able to join the NAACP and destroy it? You know, you think you can do this, but certainly you wouldn't support the Klan. So what you're then arguing is that anti-discrimination clauses should be applied in a discriminatory manner, depending upon whether I agree or disagree with the speech. That's not adhesion to constitutional principle. That's just severe intellectual hernia. But this isn't intellectual. It is an emotional war that we're fighting. And this is an angry young man, and he doesn't like what the Word says. And he's trying to change the truth to conform to his lifestyle. I understand that. I was once an atheist. I was once in a band. And I traveled and supported myself for 4 years as a musician. My life was crazy. Okay, I have been there. And I know that the source of my anger towards God and towards religion wasn't intellectual at all. It was a deep-seated awareness that I was doing something that was counter to the way that I was designed. And that's what drove him into that situation. He sues. He's in the Ninth Circuit. Of course he's going to win. He's in the Ninth Circuit. But thank God Almighty that the Ninth Circuit still is the most overturned circuit in the United States of America. Okay, interesting, they sided with me in my case, but I told you I'm not talking about my case, okay? But at any rate, this one we've got to deal with right now because it's going to the Supreme Court, and we're getting a written opinion on June 30th, 2010. And when that majority opinion came back from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I knew we were in serious trouble. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, well, you know what? They've told us that they have an all-comers policy at Hastings College, where every single group has open membership. They don't have fraternities and sororities there where, you know, you got some groups for men and some groups for women. All they have is belief-based organizations, and they all have the same policy. Well, there's only one flaw with that argument. It's that it's false. They actually had a chapter of La Raza, and La Raza is a radical revolutionary Hispanic group that wants to, you know, retake Arizona and retake New Mexico and make them a part of Mexico again. It's a pro-violent revolutionary group. And they actually had a belief statement that said you had to be in favor of the revolution. And it said, and oh, by the way, only Hispanics can join. Okay? They didn't have an open membership policy. They lied to the Supreme Court because this is what college administrators do. They lie constantly, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg pretended to believe them. And she said, well, it's okay to violate their rights in this, as long as you're violating everyone else's rights. Okay, if you have a situation where there's an all-comers policy for every single group, it's not like you're arbitrarily discriminating against them. Well, that doesn't resolve the issue. I mean, maybe that's the language of the 14th Amendment, but still, what happened to the freedom of association? It's a public university. They pay mandatory student activities fees. They give them back. I mean, they should be able to get some of their money back and assemble a group around their own cherished values. So this was just devastating to people out there who are involved in the free speech movement and the free association movement. And we realized that this was going to be a big problem. But you know what? We looked at it and we also realized that there just aren't many universities, if any, across America that truly have open membership policies, okay, and these open enrollment policies. So it's like CLS versus Martina said, you can do this to a Christian group and force them to admit this guy. You don't have to, but you can if you have an all-comers policy at the university. So we thought this won't have such devastating consequences. Well, what happens? The decision is rendered. In 2010, I go back to my office after getting home from Summit Ministries in August, and I get an email from the university. It says, because of CLS versus Martinez, belief-based groups now have to sign the following statement. They took the old statement before that had failed in the court of public opinion, and they tried to ram it down the throat of all the groups. What's wrong with that? It said, because of CLS versus Martinez, we have to do this. No. CLS versus Martinez says you can under certain circumstances, but you don't have to do anything. But you only can do this if there's an open membership policy. We have fraternities and sororities. It's incredible. You know how I responded to the situation when people wrote to me. I said, refuse to sign it. And tell them Mike Adams told you to refuse to sign it. That'll just tell them I'm on to the game, okay? So for a couple of years, because we'd already sued them up at UNC Chapel Hill on the same issue, freedom of association, one that I organized. Okay, so we go back, 2 years go by, and unbelievably, I can't believe this, but a group called Ratio Christi, which is a Christian apologetics group that I advise, they were told that their statement that the officers had to believe in God had to be removed. And after 2 years of kind of lying dormant, after kind of initially hinting they were going to do this, they lied dormant, they actually chose to do this to the group that I advised. I sent an email to the dean of students, one of the associate deans of students, and I just told them it's unconstitutional. And I said, recognize my group immediately. It wasn't a request, it was a demand. And they wrote back and they said that my demand and intrusion into the situation was inappropriate. I got on the phone and called Robert Shibley, the vice president for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And we drafted a public records request asking for copies of every single constitution because we thought they were targeting people. They received that on Monday of the next week. On Tuesday, 36 hours after I sent them a registered letter implying that they might get sued in the situation, the administration wrote back and said, a funny thing happened. The person who was approving Ratio Christi, her name is Stacy Basden, she didn't realize that we just wrote this brand new policy that said that belief-based groups, whether they be political, social, or religious in nature, have complete authority on who they allow to be members, on who they allow to be officers, and in what they believe, and we are not going to interfere with them at all. We won that battle in 36 hours. They got the letter, and they convened an emergency meeting, and they realized that they were about to lose another lawsuit on the same issue, because they were pretending to have an all-comers policy when they did not have an all-comers policy. Now, where did the policy come from? My goodness, that's a fast way to come up with a policy. A bunch of professors with tenure didn't write it. You can't get them to work in 36 hours. Well, it came from UNC Chapel Hill. And UNC Chapel Hill had actually finally come up with the right answer. And UNCW decided that they were going to have an emergency meeting, cut and paste the policy, put it up on the website, and voted in. And that's what they did. And that leads me into the direction of what we need to do on our campuses. We still have an absolutely incredible mess out there with all of these groups, all of these universities having all of these different policies, and we need to do something about it. And the reason we need to do something about it is that the students routinely sign away their rights because they don't know what their rights are. The best way to deprive a generation of young people of their rights is to not tell them that they have the rights in the first place. And the society will be fundamentally transformed within one generation. And so what must we do? Well, I believe that there are three things that we need to do, and they are all extremely important. One of those is we have to continue the litigation. I would ask you guys, if you're out there and you're supporting certain organizations and you're not happy with, you know, I don't know if you've been in this situation, but there have been ministries and things that I've supported, and they do something I disagree with, and I don't want to support them anymore. And I'll tell you something, in recent years, I have had to change my donating habits in a number of different circumstances. And if you all are looking for someone to support, you need to take a good, long look at the Alliance Defending Freedom, at the American Center for Law and Justice, because these people just came through for me, and they will come through for young people as well. I think that one of the most amazing things about it was that back when I was an atheist in the early 1990s, I used to watch Pat Robertson on CBN just because I was angry and I needed someone to swear at. And Jay Sekulow used to come on national television. I used to curse at him. I never knew that someday he would represent me in a federal lawsuit and we'd win. God is amazing, isn't he, in what he can do. And the Alliance Defending Freedom, one of the founders of that was James Kennedy. I used to curse at him on Sunday mornings with a hangover. I had nothing better to do, ladies and gentlemen. But these awesome groups are still around and fighting the good fight. We've got to support them. And job number one is we've got to continue to fight in the courts of law. Because I'll tell you, 90% of the universities had patently unconstitutional speech codes when I began speaking out against them around 2003. Just over a decade later, that number is down to approximately 58%. We are in a situation where in just a few years, most of our college campuses will be free of these speech codes. And not having the speech codes is going to be the norm. But we have to continue the full frontal assault in the court of law. But there are two other things that we need to do. The second thing that we need to do that is extremely important is to pass religious liberty bills. Now, the good thing about this is that if we have legislators out there, you don't have to write the bill. The model bill exists. It was written in Ohio. Virginia's picked it up, and I took it and modified it and passed it on to the Senate last year. It got shifted over to the House. It passed by a vote of 70-42, but it got lost in the shuffle, and the governor never signed it. So I got to keep fighting this one for a couple of years. But Ohio did this religious liberty bill that said, even at the junior colleges, you can't interfere with the belief structure of religious groups or political groups, and you can't even interfere with their internal governance. If you're going to force them to pay mandatory student activities fees and then make them go through a recognition process to get their money back, they're going to decide exactly what the terms are by which they will receive the money that is rightfully theirs in the first place. And Ohio wrote a perfect bill, and it's beginning to spread across the United States of America. Montana needs to adopt that bill. If you don't think you have a serious problem with this right now, remember, these erosions of our liberty are always waiting around the corner. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I'll tell you something, that is something that we need to do, and it needs to spread across the country. But one of the things I think that I'm absolutely the most proud of that we've been able to accomplish was this thing known as the SAE Act. And I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about this because I believe that Montana needs to know about it. I believe that every state in the union needs to know about it because there's not one panacea out there for all of our problems, but this bill is the closest thing to it. It's incredibly good. In the fall of 2012, a fraternity, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, was actually thrown off campus. And there was a strange thing that happened where the kids were actually accused of having some kind of a fraternity gathering off campus at a private home. It was actually the home of the president and the vice president. There was an accusation that some kid was in a pledge in the front yard, and someone was forcing him to do push-ups. And then some folks were out there drinking beer, and some of the kids out there drinking beer might have been underage. Just an accusation. The police were called, and there's this weird situation at our university where all of the calls that go to college students' homes actually get channeled into the university police and then channeled into the dean's office. If you get a noise complaint at my university, you live off campus, and it's dismissed because there's nothing to it, you get called in the dean's office, and you have to explain it. It's this weird totalitarian infrastructure that we have because the administrations have exploded on our college campuses. If any of you wonder why education is so expensive, in 1993, when I was hired as a college professor, the chancellor made $98,000. Within 15 years, we had 153 college administrators making over $100,000. Now, there's a whole reason for that federal intervention. They're giving loans, so then everyone goes to college, and it affects the supply and demand ratio. That means tuition goes up, and what do? They just hire assistants, and they just the administrative class just explodes. It's no different than Washington, D.C., and once a position is created, it never goes away. But what it has resulted in is this massive dean of students division where they have all of this supervision over what the students are doing. And what happened was is that they called these kids in and they talked to them. And they had suspicion that there may have been an alcohol violation. So they set up a hearing and they called the leadership of SAE in. And they start asking them about possibly supplying liquor to underage kids. and they said, we would like to have an attorney present. And the University of North Carolina at Wilmington says, you don't have a right to an attorney because this isn't a criminal proceeding, it's administrative. The government is questioning people about criminal conduct and saying, we'll just take the label criminal and throw it in the trash and just call it something else and dispense with the Sixth Amendment. And so the kids rightfully said, we're not going to talk to you if you don't give us a lawyer. And I've heard a tape, the kids were smart enough to tape the entire hearing. And I listened to the entire thing, and the administrators are telling them, you better speak to us respectfully because we also have a speech code, the Seahawk Respect Compact. You better not violate that. And it just goes on and on. And the kids say, no, we're not going to talk about incriminating conduct. So what do? They throw them off the campus. They throw them off the campus for several years. And then all of a sudden, the phone rings, and it's Parks Griffin, and he's the former chapter advisor and an alumnus of the university. And he calls me on the phone, and he says, I am dumbfounded by what the university has done. They wouldn't allow them to have counsel. They went in, they were facing the university counsel without their own and being asked about criminal conduct. And he says, I can't believe this has happened. This is a violation of the Sixth Amendment, isn't it? And I said to him, actually, it isn't, if there is no criminal sanction. It's really not. He says, well, what is the solution? I said, the solution is not to go through the court system in this particular circumstance. The solution is to go through the legislature. And what we're going to do is we're going to craft a thing which is going to be the first right to counsel bill in the United States of America that says that no student group, says that no individual student can be expelled from the university or can even be temporarily suspended from the university unless they have a right to counsel. So that the university attorney has to face their attorney in a fair hearing. And as we were beginning to get this together, we thought, who will sponsor the bill? Well, the Republicans took over the House that year for the first time since 1898. And it just so happened that one of my former students by the name of John Bell got elected to the legislature. And it just so happens he was a member of SAE. And we called him up and said, would you like to sponsor a bill that is the very first of its kind in the United States of America? And he responded by saying, giddy up. And he's not even from Texas. But he's had my class before, and he knows how you're supposed to respond in situations like that. And as we're gathering this thing together, an incredible thing happens in the spring. I'm sending them up, and I've got my recommendations for how the bill should be written. It goes up to Robert Shibley at the FIRE, and he writes almost the entire thing. We're getting it prepared for the next legislative session. And all of a sudden, a crazy situation happens on my campus. A young black student is rooming with two white students on the campus, and they begin to have arguments with one another. And then all of a sudden, in the argument, she uses profanity. She has a little bit of a temper. I have talked to her about that. And they give her a warning for a thing known as disorderly conduct. A second argument takes place, and she uses profanity for a second time. And they bring her in for a hearing. And before that, the police come and visit her. And they're doing an investigation over an argument between roommates. And they take testimony from the white roommates. And they take testimony from my student. And they convene a hearing in the Dean of Students' office. And they show up, and my student is looking at the record, and they've redacted her statements and shortened them and left all the statements of the opposing side in. And she sits there and she realizes that the whole hearing has been fixed and that they decided to throw her out of school in April and not give her a tuition remission. And she's like, what do I do in that situation? Well, she asked for an attorney. And they said, no, you have no right to counsel. And they had the hearing. And at the end of the hearing, they hand her a piece of paper. And it's the verdict. They've decided to expel her from the university. They printed the verdict before they actually had the hearing. The entire thing was a kangaroo court that was staged. And I told her to appeal this thing to the vice chancellor. And luckily, by the grace of God, she went and she was able to file an appeal. As exam week is approaching, she's not studying. She's trying as hard as she can to stay in the university because she's been thrown out in this ex parte proceeding. Her without an attorney, facing the university attorney with doctored testimony and a verdict they've written up in advance. And as this is going on, I realize the urgency of us passing this bill. We got the bill written, and we took it to the House, and it passed by a vote of 112-1. But this one didn't die. It went to the desk of Governor Pat McCrory, and it was signed into law. And we called it the Student Administrative Equity Act. That spells S-A-E. And it is now the law in the state of North Carolina. Now, anytime you want to throw a student or a student group off campus, you have to allow them to have their own attorney. Do you see the beauty of this? This ties into everything that we've talked about this evening. We are so fearful that our young people will go off to a college campus and that they will say something about their opposition to same-sex marriage, that they will say something about their opposition to abortion, and they will throw them out of the university. But they can't throw them out of the university without having some kind of a hearing. They always have a hearing. We worry about our young Christian groups going off and saying, this is what we believe. And we worry about the university saying, no, you don't. Keep it to yourself. Get back in the closet, Christian. And if you don't do it, we'll throw you off the campus. The SAE Act is the remedy to all of those other problems associated with free speech and associated with freedom of association. Because now, if they're going to do it, they have to stare opposing counsel in the face. And they have to deal with them. And I am predicting that the long-term effect of the SAE Act is we will have fewer prosecutions, not just for alcohol-related behavior or for disorderly conduct, but we will have fewer hearings dealing with the CLS versus Martinez issue, and we will have a substantially diminished enforcement of the campus speech code because they can't just decide in advance what the verdict is and doctor the evidence and throw them out of the university without facing the other side. So what we need desperately is young Christian people who have been on the college campuses in recent years and know how very bad the climate is to take their experiences to the legislature and to sponsor bills that offer due process and right to counsel for young Christian students on our secular campuses, but also to pass these religious liberty bills as well. If we can continue to litigate at this rate and continue to drive it from 90 down to 58 where it is now and into a minority and a situation where a minority of the campuses actually has these campus speech codes, if we combine that with religious liberty legislation and with due process assurances for students, we can fight this war and we can win. We have to send a strong moral message to young people. It's not okay to tell people what they believe and what they don't believe. It's not okay to censor speech just because you can't think of a rebuttal. It's not fair to deprive people of their property, tuition, without due process. Because to the extent that these things become normal, and we allow them to be normal on the college campus today, they will be normal in the larger society within a generation. And that's why we have to take it to them right now. And I hope this evening I've told you exactly what we need to do. I thank you for allowing me to speak to you this evening. I think we've got time for some questions.
But here are the rules.
I wrote them.
But first, I have to say, Mike, for going on 3 years, we've advocated for the idea, the need, the necessity of Christians moving beyond just being in their churches to engaging the culture that we're losing. You have given us a beautiful picture of what that looks like.
Thank you.
do you have you put together, or one of the ADF or the others, have you put together a handbook that students can refer to?
Actually, the FIRE has done that. That is such a great question. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, I keep going back to them because they're pioneers in this area. And they published a number of years ago, for example, we talked a lot about religious liberty. They did a basic guide that's about 50 pages or 50 or 60 pages that explains, well, what are the major decisions? What are the rules, basically? And it was written by my attorney, David A. French. And so naturally, I would recommend that to you. What's really awesome about the FIRE is that you can actually go and download that free of charge off of their website. And if you write to them and ask them to send you a free copy, they'll send one to you. And I know that college students, there's only one thing that they like more than pizza and t-shirts. That's free stuff. So that's where you go, thefire.org.
So how does this whole thing about the school translate now into a workplace that might not allow Christianity? Or has that already been done?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. When I talk about how the things being normalized on the campus eventually begin to be accepted in the culture as being normal, I think we've already seen how, you know, the movement towards diversity and all that was born on campuses, and what we see is this is moving into other institutions, including the workplace. And, it's just going to affect all realms of behavior, including the private workplace. Because if people accept things as being normal ways of doing things in terms of fairness and things of that nature, then, you know, it's something that's going to arrive in the workplace. I think it already has, basically. And, it's no coincidence that we see a lot of the same types of workshops and things of that nature occurring in the workplace as well. A lot of this, of course, has to do with lawsuit avoidance. And there's one thing that I want people to understand when we see this stuff that spilled over in the workplace that started on the campus. One of the incentives for having all of these speech codes and cracking down on racial harassment and the water buffalo thing and all these crazy cases is that universities want to be able to say that they're doing something in case they get sued. The problem is that if you overdo it to prevent one type of suit, you open yourself up for another. And the calculus that's going on is that the campuses are worried, well, we're going to get suits for racial harassment, we're going to get suits for sexual harassment, and so the pendulum swings in the opposite direction. How do you knock it backward? By showing people that they can be sued for this other thing as well. Okay, and that's why, once again, the importance of litigation in groups like ADF and ACLJ.
It's, I remember, Sherry, where are you? There you are. 2 or 3 years ago, you remember when we were having this conversation, Sherry Olson, about going to city council? And if a conservative shows up, they're shocked. And it makes a difference.
Yeah.
You pointed out many great points about the colleges and how they have many injustices there. Do you feel it's worth addressing the high school situations that sometimes go on as well?
Yeah. Thank you. There's a weird thing that's going on with the high schools. There's a difference between the level of First Amendment rights that you have in a high school versus a college. And the definitive case on that is the Kuhlmeier case from 1988. I strongly encourage people to read that case. And you have diminished rights on a high school campus. But I think the thing that we need to remember is that you don't suffer a constitutional death when you go onto a public high school campus. So it's possible. I think we need to be mindful of violations in both places, but just understanding that we have lesser rights on the high school campus. One of the very strange things that happens, we recently had a case at San Luis Obispo at Cal Poly, where they actually tried to prevent kids who were running for SGA president from distributing any materials or taking out any advertisements. And they had this very broad-based ban on their private behavior and so on and so forth. They actually quoted the Kuhlmeier case, which only applies to high schools. So it's kind of interesting. You know, even sometimes college administrators will pretend not to know the difference. We need to be better than that and understand that high school students do have diminished First Amendment rights. And so we need to be more selective about what we do on high school campuses. And we just need to cover cases that are more extreme, basically. And just be selective. Be winsome. Kuhlmeier is K-U-H-L-M-E-I-R. I can't believe I got that right. Okay? Thank you.
Yeah, I often run up to the college and engage the kids in different kinds of things.
Good.
And I'm wondering what kind of trouble I can get into. Is there, you have any advice on what to avoid? Or
what kind of things are you engaging them about?
Worldview.
Oh, good. Well, on what campuses?
The local campus, MSUB.
Okay, yeah. I think it's really awesome that you're doing that. You know, I don't know if you guys follow Stand to Reason, but Stand to Reason is one of the best Christian apologetics groups out there. And I've got some friends that work there, and they're pretty awesome. And Brett Kunkel is one of them. And that guy is just insane in a good way. I mean, he decided a few years ago that he wanted to train young people to defend their faith. Sean McDowell's done this as well, by taking them up to UC Berkeley. Okay, he drives them up there, and they just will go out there, and they'll start engaging people, you know, and they'll look for the atheist groups that are doing tabling, and they'll go up there, and they'll start to debate with them, about creationism and things of that nature. And I just think that the idea is just really fantastic. But in terms of ideas about how you go about doing that, what I would strongly suggest that you do is look into two groups. Ratio Christi is one of them. Kind of take a look at what they're doing.
I've got my own deal about that, so I don't have a problem engaging him. I'm wondering what kind of trouble that I might have to look out for from the university.
Well, one of the things is the Leadership Institute strongly recommends that when you go there that you always bring a video camera, basically, and be prepared to videotape any incidents that occur. And what I would say is you really do. You really can't trust the campus police these days. I mean, they are really awfully authoritarian. So that's one step that you take. But the other thing is that you actually familiarize yourself with their policies. For example, their speech zones and the time limitations and the permit processes that they have. And familiarize yourself with those things first. And if anything appears to be suspect, if you're concerned that something is overly broad and it abuses time, place, and manner restrictions, contact the ADF directly. They've actually got a phone number. It's 1-800-TELL-ADF. And if there's questionable policy, you can send them a link. And I think that kind of prevention is just a good idea. Know their policy.
We're just so grateful to ADF. You know, has been here. Jeff Ventrilo has been here twice and had friends here, and they do some great things. Thanks so much for coming tonight. Call somebody in the morning and bring them, because we got work to do.
Yes.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much.